You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan of the Heralds of the Gospel, and today we are continuing our survey into the cardinal virtue of justice. Our last week, we were looking at the final point being the insensibility to mercy. Mercy, the quality of mercy. The other element to this lack of justice will be falsehood and deceit. The covetous will exhibit false prudence, namely cunning. They can be very clever and for the most part have many people fooled, but they are entirely false. Their words and actions do not aim to reveal but to conceal, for they cannot achieve their ends without, unless they appear to others as entirely normal. Their lying becomes perjury when confirmed under oath. A man who lies under oath, that is, while calling on God as his witness, has lost himself. As Bolt, Robert Bolt in the play Man for All Seasons, says, has Moore saying to his daughter while he visited in prison, "When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding himself in his hands like water. When he opens his fingers, he needn't hope to find himself again." This is an example of how loving oneself to the point of covetousness leads to a tragic loss of self. We love ourselves so much that we become nothing. We lose ourselves. We lose our purpose. And that's why when people who are stuck in this rut by some action of grace or assistance of God get out of it and they begin to do something for the other, they find themselves. That finding of self is the action of this beautiful virtue. Covetousness leads to acts of violence. And that violence that violates others because the person regards others as means to his own end. His will is that others conform in his way of seeing and treating them. When others refuse to use, manipulate, take advantage of, and when they have come to see through the deception of false life and thus have become a threat to his own facade, they will violate them in another way. Either it's physical or by sowing discord, which involves lying to a certain other person in order to destroy friendships, to keep them apart, that is, from talking, possibly sharing stories. He will engage in distraction, which is attacking the good name of another, which is speaking in a way which violates the honor and reputation of another. This, of course, can lead to false accusations, which murders a person's reputation. A false accusation is some ways worse than murder, for it alienates the accused and leaves him in a profound state of loneliness, misunderstood by almost everyone. It leaves a strain, a stain, a mark on the victim, like a huge stain of ink that clings to the flesh and will not come off no matter how hard the person scrubs and whatever he uses to remove it. A false accusation naturally leads to false testimony and perjury, and thus the complete destruction of the liar. Mockery. We use that in Shakespearean English, which means defy, but here we use it in the more modern sense. To mock is to laugh contemptuously at another, to shame another by exposing his faults and vices to jest. A great deal of comedy today has turned into mockery. Many enjoy this kind of humor because envy and covetousness are rather widespread. Genuine humor returns us to the soil, the humus, or the humility, to the matter of our humanity. In this way, it lightens the spirit, or it lifts the spirit out of its over-preoccupations with the affairs of the material world, and allows us to see ourselves at a distance. And so we laugh, but mocking humor is less a return to the soil than it is to soiling another. It is not much humor as it is humiliation. To mock is to laugh contemptuously at another, to shame another for exposing his faults. Isn't that what people do today? Isn't that considered being a good sport? How much lack of justice do we have? Treachery, 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 treachery. What is treachery? The covetous person has no friends. Everyone's a tool, an instrument good for relative value. When a tool is of no use anymore, it is discarded or sold. This type of person has no loyalty. They see no absolute value in fidelity. They do not love justice. Virtue is only in appearance, not in the heart. So anyone who is no longer of use is discarded or sold for a price. That is the reason why the facade of the fraudulent, narcissistic, is in constant collapse. He'll eventually be exposed by his victims of his treachery. How much of our world is filled with this? This element of disposability. I once heard put like this. People today look at relationships as one looks at their iPhone. When the iPhone comes out, people are willing to wait in the cold to buy one for whatever price it costs. They adore it. They cover it in packages and cases and what have you. And then 10 months down the road, a new one comes out. And they discard the first as though it has no value and embrace the second. And that cycle will continue continually over the next year or so. And this is based in this element with our society, which we lack justice in a most profound level, and which we treat others as tools. Granted, the iPhone is a tool, but as the example of inordinate love, it fits the example. A small step from treachery is murder. This type of man does not look at the world in terms of the common good, but at the most and only terms of his collective good. He has no eyes for the common good, for everything is referred to himself. The former is an immaterial good that does not diminish as a number of partakers increase. Common good versus collective good. The collective good, on the other hand, diminishes as a number of partakers increases, like a meal or a financial reward. The covetousness leads to a confusion between common good of the social whole and the collective good. for they see the increase in population not as a blessing, but as a threat to their share of the collective good. If a person loves his own love more than the life of the other, he tends to open to the idea of contraception and abortion. The step from contra-life behavior to contraception, the murderous acts of abortion, infanticide, are not large ones. Hence, when they signed the directive, the NNSSM 200 directive, signed by Henry Kissinger, it upholded abortion as a vital part of the global well-being. And that's because of this element of lack of justice, of lack of seeing the good in others. So, on the positive side, a truly just man is affable. But not all affable people are just. For the unjust, affability is a means of deception, an opportunity to string someone along. That is why their particular brand of affability will often exceed the mean of reason and become flattery. The defect of affability is a vice belonging to those not smart enough to employ manipulation. It's unfriendliness, uncordiality, and disagreeableness. The just man is aware that since he likes to be treated cordially, he ought to will to cultivate and maintain agreeable relations in social life. One who is too preoccupied with himself, too much at the mercy of his own moods, will tend to lack due cordiality. So too, a young person who wishes to appear invulnerable tends to lack affability and will fail to do his part in creating a light and agreeable atmosphere. Piety. Why does piety fit into this? Interesting. Whenever and wherever there is a debt, there is an object of justice, thus a special part of the virtue of justice. Some debts, however, cannot be fully remitted, such as the debt we hold towards our parents. For they chose to accept the difficult burden of pregnancy, delivery, and child rearing. They chose to cooperate with God generously, one that loved us into existence for our own sake. It was not possible for us to earn existence. Our parents played a part in giving us the sheer gift of human existence. So there is nothing we can do to completely repay their generosity. To attempt to do so presumes that existence. Furthermore, the debt owing to our parents who raised their children properly is in terms of our ability to satisfy. Interesting. Even more out of our reach. The reason that a proper upbringing is so crucial to the development of prudence, the mother of all virtues, remember we've got back to that, as well as the development of justice, which in turn is necessary for the development of prudence. Good parenting is a cornerstone of civilization. For there is no prudence without right orientation, that is, the ordering to a right end. A person who has made himself an ultimate end of all he does, the center of his universe, cannot be prudent, only cunning. Unless the will and sensitive appetites are oriented to the right end, namely the common good of the social whole, ultimately with union with God, there is no genuine prudence, thus no true virtue. Moreover, common good depends on good law, which in turn depends upon just and prudent legislators, a just and prudent citizenry that will obey just laws and elect worthy leaders. But a child who fails to recognize nobility, unless he has been properly and carefully raised, loved, guided, educated, and corrected. Aristotle writes, "For the moral excellence is concerned with pleasures and pains. It is on the account of the pleasures that we do bad things, and the account of pain that we abstain from noble ones. Hence, we ought to have been brought up in a particular way from our very youth. As Plato says, so as both to delight in and to be painted by things that we ought. For this is right education. Now, in light of the fact that the virtue of the principle of emotional stability and means of happiness, the debt of gratitude owing to a good parent, is quite simply impossible to fully satisfy. But justice demands that we begin to try, that is, to satisfy it as much as we reasonably are able. Piety is that part of justice which we manifest the honor, respect, and reverence we owe to our parents. The social whole has a special debt to good parents. At the same time, for their health and well-being, is directly dependent on the way that they choose to carry out the burdensome responsibility of child-rearing. The reality of this debt should in some visible way be reflected in law. Filial piety. How much of it can we talk about? But how much is it absent in our society? How much? So we have justice as an element towards God and towards man, towards ourselves and towards our neighbor. To give each its due, but do we understand what is due? Do we understand who it's due to? When we become too introverted and too self-interested, we sin against justice. When we act out, we sin against justice. When people destroy others, we act against justice. All these elements are acting against justice. And justice isn't the most important of all the virtues. It's pretty much the second tier. But we see how important the cardinal virtues are. Once I'm finished here with justice, I'm hoping to go back and to make a revisiting of prudence and temperance. Because I think we went very quickly over them and we can go deeper into them. So let's look very quickly at observance. Those who hold public office have their principal task the maintenance of the common good. We understand that. Not their private good. I'm not sure about that. To fulfill this task well requires a high level of personal integrity, a very ordered and integrated life in which their emotions are subject to just will and a prudent mind. To hold public office worthily requires a will perfected by distributed justice, as well as a mind well disposed by the specific type of prudence and corresponds to the office in question, such as political prudence, pedagogical prudence, if the office is an educator, military prudence, if it's a police officer or an army official. The debt we owe to those in public office worthily is one also that cannot be fully remitted. As we spoke about before, we are beneficiaries of the labor of countless others who have gone before us. Most of these people did not hold public offices. But we have to observe the justice that is due to them, such as a governor, a president, a premier, a prime minister, a member of parliament, a police officer, a superintendent, a principal, a vice principal, our own teachers. So, do we give them proper justice? Do we give them their proper due? And if not, then we should start. Do we give them the charity they deserve? But we're going to go to our break. And with that, we're going on the other side. We're going to talk about patriotism in the fact of justice. And if this was the United States, this would be a very hot button issue. But in Canada, we're pretty cool about it. So we're going to look into justice and patriotism. Be back in a quick moment's time.
You are listening to the Catechism Hour, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice, wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. Justice, the rule of law, the right. Now we're going to talk about patriotism, love of country. You see that I'm using the word patriotism and not nationalism. As it's defined, patriotism is something which is good, but nationalism is something not so good. So let's go into what is patriotism, and we'll answer those questions that you may have. Patriotism is a virtue annexed to justice that bears upon the country as a whole, including its entire history. It is a love for the civil community and a willfulness to sacrifice and to satisfy as far as possible the debt we owe to it. This will involve showing due honor to the country, which includes standing for the country's national anthem, a willfulness to defend the country should it find itself under attack. It is no coincidence that those who couldn't be bothered standing respectfully for their country's national anthem also evidence a lack of sense of gratitude to the country as a whole. Such people are unaware that they are beneficiaries of the generosity and labor of millions. Not just one, but millions. Within today's culture of individualism, has even been called to their attention such a notion. On the contrary, a great many of the Western world's nations seem to have been brought up to think mainly in the terms of their private rights and not their public duties. Individualism is and has affected some countries more than others. For example, one of the greatest failures of Canada since the introduction of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms has been the complete neglect of the emphasis of this part of justice, such as general justice, observance, piety, religion, and the rightly ordered individual towards a social whole, either directly or indirectly. In the minds of many people, the civil community alone is the subject of duties and has the sole obligation to supply the condition for the free exercise of individual liberties, while individual citizens need only concern themselves with their subjective rights. The individualism of the 60s and 70s is a philosophical and cultural framework that spawned the Canadian Charter in particular, which tends to confuse the distinction between objective and subjective rights. For the proper object to be right is that it should be just. As we point out above, and we talked about already, right refers to the just, implying the relation of equality between people. An objective right is a thing or an action due to another. The civil community as a whole has an objective right, which patriotism, legal justice, observance have as their object. In other words, citizens have the obligation towards the social whole. A subjective right is a moral power that the individual person possesses for doing or acquiring something, which is the right to vote, or the right to freedom of opinion and expression. A subjective right, however, is dependent upon the objective right, the moral power that one has to call the right in relation to a consequence upon objective right, a thing or action due to itself. The right to marry, to beget new life, for example, has always been grounded in the duty towards the common good. For the society proceeds from the family unit, as organs of a body proceed from its cells. So as we have generously given life, education, and a culture and a religious heritage, we owe it to our country, our parents, and to God to continue that generosity. The civil community as a whole has the right to expect certain level of generosity and loyalty from its citizens. Indeed, every individual person has rights, and this presupposes the duty of the state to establish the ensemble of material and other conditions to favor the realization of each and every person's own flourishing, which of course includes the realization of each one's obligations to its equals, to its parents, to the social whole, and to God. It's interesting here, which we talk about God being so important, how our parents are so important, and then our country. And we live in a society where the parents have been pushed out of the equation, God has left the scenario, and our country becomes something of an afterthought. When we reverse the relationship between objective and subjective rights, such as the subjective right becoming primary, then the order of law and the justice become subordinate to liberty, freedoms of the individuals. When this happens, the aim of society becomes freedom, not justice, or common good. The outcome is almost complete and utter lack of patriotism of the citizenry, and especially amongst those who are young. Moreover, when the individual liberty is held up as an absolute end, it necessarily relativizes the moral order and the order of rights, making them completely subjective. When the individual liberty becomes an end above and beyond the common good, the individual freedoms, such as those typically listed in the modern Charter of Rights, will lack objective criteria that justly limit them. Within a such context, a legal decision is bound to be unprincipled, ad hoc, and thus unpredictable. But the right of the individual liberty is subordinate to the common good of the social order. Individual freedoms are limited by my duties to the common good and the civil community, and that is by the objective rights of the civil community to expect certain just actions from me. How does that work with me? This is what's going on in our country. We don't have... It's almost as though jurisprudence is based on pre-82 and post-82. Because you flipped everything on its head, liberty becomes the end, not good government. The very foundations of Canada get flipped around. So, what happens with patriotism? Patriotism naturally includes the defense of the patria, of the country, of the motherland. So patriotism includes the willfulness to defend the country should it find itself under attack. Of course, there are rules concerning this. There are moral rules concerning it. St. Thomas talks a lot about it. And we're looking at this as a morally understandable and explainable war, not one that is morally unexplainable. The willfulness to defend our country should find itself under attack. The patriot is willing it to fall in battle for the future generations as others before them have done. So the patriot wants to maintain his country so that others in the future will also have an opportunity to live that life that he has lived. Not only is there an increasing widespread, not to mention questionable, rejection of the death penalty as itself unjustifiable, but seems to be increasingly widespread, unqualified, and absolute rejection of war as something in itself contrary to peace. But it may very well be the case that such a movement also hides something far more insidious, such as the growing indifference towards oppression and injustice, a cowardly unwillingness fall in battle for something larger than oneself, such as the common good that is threatened externally by an unjust power. It may speak of an unwillingness to expand oneself through love, unwillingness to love others in another country as another's self, so as to willingly come to their aid and to help them in their defense. What better way to hide such depravity than to shroud it under the cloak of a peace sign? Aquinas, the great doctor, St. Thomas Aquinas, argues quite persuasively that the war is not unlawful in itself, and not unnecessary, and not unnecessarily contrary to peace. In fact, it can very well be an act of peacemaking. In order for war to be just, a number of things are necessary. The authority of the sovereign must be just and illegitimate. Only that authority can command the war to be waged. For the public authority has, as its primary duty, the protection of the common good of its city, province, country, subject to them. So the private citizen cannot legitimately declare war. St. Thomas Aquinas argues that there is a duty to wage war under certain circumstances. And to back that up, he quotes Psalm 82, verse 4. Rescue the poor, deliver the needy out of the hand of the sinner. Hence, a just cause is required for a just war. A just cause aims not only at defending the just order, but also at restoring just order, which was disrupted by an external enemy of the state. It is demanded by the virtue of vindication, existing in the will of the public authority. It is necessary for those waging war to have right intention, which the intention to protect the common good, to promote it, and not as a motive to aggrandizement and of revenge. The intention must be secure peace, to restore the just order and to establish common good. As St. Thomas Aquinas writes, for it may happen that the war is declared for legitimate authority, for a legitimate cause, but yet rendered unlawful through a wicked intention. There are four objections that St. Thomas treats in the Summa regarding these questions. Three of them are particularly relevant. He first cites Matthew 26:52. All that take the sword shall perish by the sword. The second objection cites the Sermon on the Mount. But I say to you, do not resist evil. as well as a letter of Paul to the Romans 12:19. Not revenging yourselves, my dearly beloved, but give no place to wrath. The third objection makes the argument that nothing except sin is contrary to the act of virtue, and that since war is contrary to peace, war is always a sin. To the first objection, St. Thomas points out that to take the sword is to arm oneself in order to take the life of another, without the command of proper authority. This is not the same as having recourse to the sword as an instrument of public authority, to use it as a commissioned by the authority, which is the charge of common good. His reply to the second objection refines his argument. He says that we ought to keep the biblical precepts cited well in mind so as to be ready to obey them, and if necessary, to refrain from self-defense. Nevertheless, he argues that at times necessary for us to act otherwise for the sake of the common good, even for the good of those who are fighting. Here he quotes St. Augustine. Those whom we have to punish with kindly severity, it is necessary to handle in many ways against their will. For when they are stripping a man of lawfulness, it is good for him to be vanquished, since nothing is more hopeless than the happiness of a sinner. Whence arises guilty impunity, an evil will like an internal enemy. To the third objection, St. Thomas simply replies, those who wage war justly aim at peace, so they are not opposed to peace. I've heard, all of us have heard, and considered arguments of pacifists over the years and of absolute prohibition of war. The arguments have not been able to sign up to the simplest tests of common sense reasoning. For example, should a disgruntled student or two come to school with a semi-automatic weapon and start firing randomly at every young person in sight? Would a pacifist argue that the administrators have a duty not to call the police, since the police carry guns and are willing to use them? What is it? The question of pacifism and of patriotism is very important, and it's something that's dialogued and talked about very much. And we can dig deeper and deeper and deeper into this. And as time gives, maybe in the future sometime, we will actually have an answer. But our last one that we're going to look at for justice is religion. Not only do we have a debt towards our parents and country, a debt we cannot completely remit, we also have a debt towards God that is logically impossible to satisfy. For everything we have, every human, instrumental, common good we enjoy ultimately comes from God. For God is the first existential cause of all that we are, such as all other humans, the goods that exist, that produce the state, that produce the law, that produce the actions, that our real acts of will and intelligence, all are a sheer gift. So the most perfect part of justice is the virtue of religion, by which one renders in some way what is due to God. No matter what a person does, it's his attempt to remit his debt to God. He only renders himself more deeply in debt, for his religious acts are in themselves created by God, despite the fact that they are truly his own religious acts. For he cannot do anything unless he and his actions are made to be. The first response to the generosity of the giver is to say thank you. And so in prayer, in particular, the prayer of thanksgiving is the first interior act of religion by which a person renders due honor and worship to God. We also honor God by recognizing our utter dependency upon him, and thus restraining inordinate hope that we might have in ourselves. The prayer of petition, prayer of praise, adoration, follow by significant reflection on divine providence. How much do we do of that? How much prayer do we put in? How much of this virtue of religion do we practice? Gratitude demands that one should pay back more than when one receives. St. Thomas writes, Gratitude regards the favor received according to the intention of the benefactor, who seems to be deserving of praise, chiefly for having conferred the favor gratis, without being bound to do so. Wherefore, the beneficiary is under the moral obligation to bestow something gratis in return. Now, he does not seem to bestow something gratis unless he exceeds the quantity in favor received. Because so long as he repays less or the equivalent, he would seem to be doing nothing gratis, only to return what he has received. Therefore, gratitude always inclines, as far as possible, to pay back more than what was given. But it is not possible to exceed the giver in this case, neither in deed nor in will. But it is sufficient if there is a very ardent will to repay as much as possible that one has received. It is the will that leads to the worship of God, to the complete surrender of one's entire person to Him, making Him the center round our lives revolve. This will is so strong that it seeks to express itself through external acts of religion, through religious ritual, expressing devotion, and including acts of sacrifice. We see this in the Jewish offerings of the first fruits of harvest, an act that makes visible the interior feeling of gratitude and recognition of the utter dependence upon divine providence. God is the origin of everything that is. He is the ultimate end towards all things tend. And for all things are inclined and more fully. God is fullness of being. Ipsum essent substantis. Man is also naturally inclined to be more fully within the limits of the human nature, but as an intellectual creature, he is open to the full and whole reality. For he understands the very notion of the whole reality, the human goods, to which he naturally inclined, all seem to be aspects of contemplation. Man tends to contemplate. He desires to contemplate things and the cause of things, seeking the highest causes and ultimately the highest cause, for his mind can taste a certain rest in the possession of these causes of knowledge. He will perpetually be restless, not necessarily miserable, until he comes to possess the highest and absolute first cause, in a knowledge which he will possess the whole reality, for in its possessing the cause, one possesses the effect, who is God. So the virtue of religion is the highest aspect of the virtue of justice. And in that, we understand in a greater sense why justice is so important, why we must give back. And to be generous is always to return more than what we received. And in that great quagmire, when we reach God, where we cannot be generous because we will never be able to give back more than we received, that demand of generosity, of love, and the external element of that. Some people say, well, it's inside, I don't externalize it. Well, that's a very sad point, because humans are made up of a soul, of course, intellect and will, but we also have a body, and we also have emotions. And those external elements have to be in communion with the internal elements. Otherwise, we end up with a kind of broken machine. And that broken machine, in the end, as he said many times, when there is something that doesn't work, it's hiding something. And in justice, we can't be fake. And in being fake, we fall into many other vices. So the virtue of justice is something for us as a hallmark, as a point of honor. It's something that we have to walk towards. We have to try to increase, to try to practice in all of its many facets, as in the other three cardinal virtues of prudence and temperance and fortitude. And I'm hoping that we'll go back and we'll talk a little bit more about those, the first two that we did before we did fortitude, prudence and temperance, to give it a more full treatment. I think we did it a poor treatment. But justice allows us a road to the heart of God, a road of goodness, to understand where is the good, and also is a very good example for ourselves to look within ourselves, to look within our heart of hearts, and to say, when I say I love the other, is it truly that I love the other, or is it just a means of loving myself? When I say that I am being prudent, is it because I just do not want to get involved? This virtue has that ability to burn off the dross of our soul and to really expose us. And this is one of the reasons why this virtue in particular is not very liked or very loved, because it hurts, it burns, it shows what we don't want to show. It makes us very truthful. And being truthful, though it's an ideal for many a person, it is not something necessarily people like. So we have to begin this journey ourselves. We've already began the journey through the sacramental life, but we should today, you know, like in the old book of Pilgrim's Progress, you know, decide to shake off the old self and start a new pilgrimage towards God. The key is that our Lord is always waiting for us to make that decision. If we found a means that we are far from Him, through the sacraments, we become quickly close, and we begin that journey with Him and begin to flake off, to tear off those elements which are not good. Take off those elements which are not of God. Take off those elements that are not true, that are lying, that are murderous, that are presumptuous, that are covetous. All of those points we need to tear away from ourselves. I call to mind in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader of C.S. Lewis, we have Eustace Scrubb, and he is useless. He is a horrible person, and he gets sucked into the world of Narnia, and Aslan wants a one-on-one with him. And he exhibits all the worst vices. And the one vice that he exhibits is his covetousness. Because of this problem, he lacks justice. He does. Going through this material, I realized he was that. And Aslan kind of lays a little bit of a trap. And the trap was a secret lair of dragon gold. And when he sees it, he lets everyone else go ahead of him. He goes in there and he dives into this gold. He puts on this gold diadems and things like that. And he falls asleep in the gold, only to awaken as a dragon. And it's not a nightmare. He is now a dragon. He is now the dragon of the gold. And he begins to fly around and begins to want to engage with his cousins. And he perceives his cousins are really good. And he begins to perceive that he has always been a dragon. He's a dragon in the inside. And Aslan tells him that he needs to be baptized. He needs to be cleaned. He needs to have this dragon-like element taken away from him. And he does it with his claws, and he slashes him. And it's painful. But he comes out like a new baby. And he's a changed person. We too need that baptism, to come into grips with justice. The justice will become something, we become our talking point, so that we can become truly the Christians we're called to be, children of Christ, children of Mary. We're called to be in a very special way just, to be like that of Christ, to be children of the Beatitudes, children of the New Testament. But to look at the admonishments that are filled within the New Testament, look at the admonishments that are found in the letter of James. We see in the beginning of the letter of the Apocalypse, the Revelations, to watch out to be not be one of those churches that has gone cold, that we burn bright with justice, and with justice that we become more than just that. All all of these cardinal virtues are important for us. We have to dig deep. But if we just memorize them and know what they are on a very superficial plane, they won't do us much good. As you dig a little deeper, you'll begin to perceive that you, unfortunately, like me, have these hooks of Satan, which are deep, which have been for many a year, that need to be taken out. And that's going to hurt. And that's going to fester, and it's going to be infected. But with the balm of the sacraments, everything is possible. With the balm of prayer, everything is good. So let's ask Our Lady to help us on this difficult journey, that we become just, prudent, tempered, and strong with the virtue of fortitude in all the ways of our life. See you next week. God bless.
You've been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bonnion, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.